Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's music row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Earth, Wind & Fire are the Black Beatles. Their influence can't be overstated. You'd be hard-pressed to find a wedding or graduation party in the last 50 years where their music didn't bring generations together to dance and sing their hearts out. Do you remember when it first died, September? Love was changing the minds, pretender, while chasing the clouds away. Earth, Wind & Fire's music is intricate, combining melody with mysticism and jazz, to create some of the most instantly recognizable and profound music of the 70s. Earth, Wind & Fire's groove is immense, and that's not an accident. Maurice White, who started Earth, Wind & Fire in 1969, spent years as a jazz drummer around Chicago before becoming a frontman. And the group's rhythm section was held down by his brothers, including Verdine White on bass. Earth, Wind & Fire might have been Maurice's musical vision, but the band's spirit always came from his younger brother, Verdine. His sheer joy for music can't be contained. On stage with his sequined outfits and long-pressed hair, Verdine dances with as much dexterity as he plays bass. Verdine has been leading the group, along with Philip Bailey, since the 90s, when Maurice stepped back from the band due to Parkinson's disease, which he ultimately passed from in 2016. Rick Rubin connected with Verdine to talk about the early days of Earth, Wind & Fire, and about their producer, Charles Stepney, who Verdine calls their George Martin. Also, Rick reads to Verdine a poignant note from the Red Hot Chili Peppers' Flea about what makes Verdine's bass playing so special.
This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond.
Here's Rick Rubin and Verdine White.
What's happening? Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. How are you, my friend?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm fantastic. So good to see you.
Yeah, I wanted to, I was just talking to Flea about that we were going to be speaking.
Uh-huh.
I want to read to you what he said.
What did Flea say?
He said, Verdine was a guy who played massive pop hits where he rocked virtuoso bass playing in the context of memorable grooves. That doesn't exist anymore. And how Earth, Wind & Fire's music appealed more than any other band of all time to all ages, all ethnicities. And when I was a kid in middle school, this is Flea talking, the black kids liked P-Funk, the white kids liked Kiss and Led Zeppelin. Everybody loved Earth, Wind & Fire. Old, young, black, white, Mexican, Asian, amazing. And a thing I've always strived for based on Earth, Wind & Fire.
Oh, wow.
Isn't it beautiful?
It's heavy. I love Flea. I've known Flea for a long time, long time, you know?
Yeah, yeah. How much do you guys practice historically?
When we do sound checks every day, I never miss a sound check. When we do big production rehearsals, it's big. It's a lot. If rehearsals start at 10 o'clock in the morning, I am there at 9. If it starts at 11, I'm there at 10. If it starts at 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm there at 3 o'clock in the morning. I still do the same things. Those same rituals have never changed for me.
Amazing. It brings up, were there any rituals that your band would do before you would go on stage? Was there any practices?
Well, we still do. We call it the circle. We get into the circle. You know, we throw everything out of the day. You know, for us, it's the start of another day. You know how you meditate in the morning and then you meditate in the evening. It's really the beginning of another day. So we throw everything out and we tune in as to what we need to do. And we have honorary members sometimes that have come to our circle. You know, Russell Wilson, you know, he was in our circle one evening. Dion Warwick was in our circle. And we invite people in sometimes to the circle because it's a sacred circle.
Beautiful.
And we say, for that night, you are in the band. You are part of the music tonight. And a lot of people want to get into the circle because they want to feel what we are feeling. And although we are all individuals, we all have different things, different lifestyles. When we get into that circle, we get into that the Earth, Wind, the EWF, or the fire vibration, you know, which we tune back into. You know, my late brother Maurice, we tune in all the work he did, all the records we did, the late Charles Stepney, our arranger, producer, you know, things like that. So we tune right back into Earth, Wind, and Fire. All those qualities, you know, as we talk about, we buy into it.
Have you always been doing this?
Forever.
Wow.
Since the 70s, forever.
Beautiful.
We have program books of back in the day when we were in the circle, our choreographers, when we had dancers, the dancers were in the circle. We've always done that. So when we go on stage, we are, you know, I'm for Dean White. We have Philip Bailey. We have Ralph Johnson. You know, the three of us are the leaders now. You know what I mean? Philip and I. But we get into the things that we created. Don't forget, we created Earth, Wind, and Fire. So we go right back to that place, you know, that sacred space of that thing, you know.
Beautiful. Beautiful. I'm so glad you do it. It's just such a beautiful thing. So it unifies the players into being not themselves anymore, but into this thing, Earth, Wind, and Fire. Would that be accurate?
That's right. Of what that is, of what we created and what we stand for, what our intentions have been, you know, because we've been around. I mean, we've had a record out every generation, right? You know, like, you know, right now we have this song out with Meghan Trainor for Christmas, but we've had records out. But now what happens with us, the older people turn the younger people on to us and they go back and start listening, you know? And what I find now that the other generations and other musicians, like Flea knows our work, but the younger musicians want to know what it's like being us and how do you get there, you know?
Yes.
And I think what's going on with the younger people, I don't think they're concerned. I think it used to be, I want to be successful. Now I think they want to be immortal and leave a legacy. And they look at us as guys that have done that. So they want to know, how do we get that? Because success comes and goes, you know, depending on the culture, depending on what the wind, like a tennis ball or a golf ball, the crosswinds could throw you off, right? You know, but when you turn out to be a legend or immortality, it stays forever.
And so few of your contemporaries have managed to keep going. Like, who were the bands? Who would you say were the competition in the early days?
Well, in the early days, it was people like Ohio Players, right? War, Mandrill, right? You know, groups like that. Commodores, right? Lionel and them, you know? And I do see Lionel, and I speak to Lionel quite a lot. And so those were our contemporaries at that time. And at that particular time, we were just kind of like starting out and we were growing up. But Maurice, because he was older than us, 10 years older, he was more mature. So he knew kind of like where we were headed, you know, where we ended up being. He was already there. You know, he was just, I think, kind of, when I look back at it, he was kind of waiting for us to catch up.
Wow.
And Reese, although he was, you know, he was a great leader. He was a tough leader. He was really actually patient with us, too. You know, and a lot of the stuff that we would do, he'd laugh at because he'd say, okay, when they get past that, then we'll have a good talk, you know. And Maurice didn't really write his book until he saw us at the Hollywood Bowl. Maurice came out, I brought him out, walked him out to the fans, and people gave him a standing ovation. That's when he decided to write the book, because he said he knew that it was in good hands. And we, that was our first time playing with an orchestra in, you know, 90 pieces. And when we played the Hollywood Bowl last year, it was beautiful, broke box office records again, Thomas Wilkins. And then we kind of got out of this, you know, we're sort of more into the, like, you know, the Earth, Wind & Fire, what it means, not into the successful part of it, because we kind of did that, you know, because success kind of dictates you or me. But our thing is you and me. So that's where we are.
Amazing. It's one of the things, it's like if I listen to any other, and I'm not limiting Earth, Wind & Fire to funk, but let's talk about funk just because it's such a, it's one of the pillars of Earth, Wind & Fire is funk. And if I look at the other funk music that I've listened to, there's always almost always a looseness about it that you guys always had a precision beyond any other band making any music related. It always seemed much tighter, much more precise, much more like fanatical in a way, like just like perfect. It was always perfect.
Absolutely. What us, we were never what you call a jam band. You know, don't forget now Maurice's background was, you know, jazz. You know what I mean? We come out of Chicago, you know, Chess Records, you know, things Maurice did, you know. But there was a precision to the music, you know, with the late Charles Stepney, with the horns, which people like Quincy respected, you know, because Quincy's work was very precise with Michael Jackson, you know what I mean? So, you know, it was always precision. Everything's on the dot, as we are now. You know, if we get a little loose, we talk about it, you know? We say, listen, we got to tighten this up here, because you can get a little loose, you know? You can get a little loose, you can forget where those bars are, you know, on maybe on the fourth night when you're a little tired, you might forget, you know, thought about, you know, you just have to remind yourself to be just a little bit more on the dot, you know?
Yeah. As it relates to bass playing, from the time that a song would come into existence, how would the bass evolve into what we hear on the record version? Like, how close would it be from the first time you play it, let's say? Tell me about the process of developing the bass.
Well, the process would be, because Maurice was a drummer, so I would hear all the songs, and he'd play me a lot of the tunes, so our groove was pretty natural, but I would always go back, and we'd go back and listen again before we record, and then he said, what do you want to do right here? What do you want to do? And then I kind of learned in a very unorthodox style, from classical to, you know, R&B, and the best teacher I ever had was the late Louis Satterfield, who was a trombone player in the Phoenix Horns, who went to college with Maurice. And so I had a chance to kind of do both, you know, look at the paper, throw the paper away, and then create my own style.
Yeah.
So a lot of times I would just listen to see what I was going to do.
Would it be a demo? Would he be a recorded demo?
Sometimes it could be a demo. Sometimes it could be when we were sitting in a room and he would just start playing. Then I would just start playing. And then while I'm playing, I would imagine, you know, I'm going to try this when I listen to it back. So I would just spend time just listening. And sometimes if Maurice was like writing with somebody, I'd lay on the couch and just listen while he was doing it. And I said, wait till I get to that. Wait till I get to my part. I knew what kind of like what I was going to do, you know, but I had room to do it in, you know. And some of the songwriters, they said, I never intended the bass to sound like that. You know what I mean? Because they sort of had a preconceived idea of what bass should sound like. And I kind of broke a lot of rules. Yeah. You know, I was not your normal guy. You know, I wasn't the perfect guy for a guy who was stuck in their ways.
That's part of why the band sounds so original, though. That's one of the keys. It's like, there are several, but that's certainly one of them.
Absolutely. And, you know, and what's really interesting about it, Rick, is that, you know, there's an Earth, Wind & Fire song being played somewhere in the world every minute and 15 seconds. Every day, every hour of the day.
Beautiful. Was the majority of the basic tracks cut live as a band?
Yeah.
So everybody's playing together?
Absolutely. And people thought that, you know, we were playing with a click track. Never did.
Wow.
Never.
Wow. It's amazing just because, again, because of the precision, they almost sound inhuman, you know, like it's so perfect. It's just beyond perfect in how tight everything is. And the horns, you know, being, that's another part of it, is like the horns are so fast and tight and it's unbelievable. It's just unbelievable to hear that kind of precision.
Yeah, well, you know, Maurice was a stickler for that. Maurice was like, you know, we think we work hard, but nobody worked as hard as Maurice. You know, he wrote it, he produced it, he performed it, and he was a hell of a performer too. And a great drummer, which he does, and a lot of the younger generation don't know how great of a drummer he really was. He played on Rescue Me, he played on Billy Stewart, Summertime. That's Maurice, you know. And he played on those great records with Ramsey Lewis. So he had a very extensive background. By the time he got to Earth, Wind & Fire, he knew who he was. You know, this was, he had no doubt who he was as a person and as an artist. This was not like something he was, you know, trying to find his way. He knew exactly what he wanted. And he dragged me along with him, so I'm happy for that, you know.
No, absolutely beautiful. And that you had a beautiful life getting to play music. It's like, what better contribution can you make than making something that enlivens you and the people that get to share it?
And with my older brother Idol, what? You know what I'm saying? You know what I mean? Sometimes when I do interviews, you know, people say, you know, what would the older Verdeen tell the younger Verdeen? And always, you know how they do, you know, you get those questions, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's not, you know, it's not a sprint, but a journey kind of thing, you know, right? You know what I mean? Right. I said, that didn't apply to me because the younger guy was already doing what he was doing. You thought about? And being with Maurice, I, you know, it kind of broke a lot of rules being a young person too, you know? They let me know that I could do it. And you know, if you stay on it, this is what you're going to do.
Hard being in a group with so many people?
Yeah, but you know, we got a lot of love and respect for each other, you know? And don't forget now, you know, Philip, Ralph, myself, you know, we became adults together. So, you know, that's a different point of view, you know?
Yeah, what year did Philip join? Do you remember, like 74?
71.
From 71?
Yeah.
Really? I didn't realize that.
I've known Philip for almost 55 years.
Wow.
And what happened when the first Earth, Wind & Fire broke up in the on the Warner Brothers, Philip used to come and hang out, and I spent the afternoon with him, you know, and we got along so well. But I had saw him play in Denver with the band, but he had moved to California, and he spent the whole afternoon, and it was just so great. I liked him so much, you know, and I called my mother. I said, he even plays harmonica, you know what I mean? I never saw anybody play harmonica, right? And then when Reese was formulating it and things like that, it was down to two other people. And Maurice said, who should we get? I said, we should get Philip. Because that's because he's a really good guy. You know what I mean? Yeah. The spirit of it, you know what I mean? And it would only take a good person to go the journey that we ended up going, you know?
In the last week, I've had a conversation with two different artists, one with Pharrell and one with Q-Tip. Two great artists referenced this week Earth, Wind & Fire being the reason they make music. Again, just right. Like it's beautiful to see it from different people, different ages, in different genres, how inspirational it was and continues to be. It's just, it's beautiful to be part of something so that has informed people's lives in such an important way.
Yeah, I think what's going on with this with the quarantine that we all are in, and it's a collective experience that we're all having, you know, as we know, people are going back, you know, to really great works, great books. They're going back to great movies. They're going back to great records. And I think, of course, our work is part of what they want to go back to, you know, and their ears are actually open more now. They're having the opportunity to listen better. You know, we've had in the great society and politics, right, and things like that. We're headed for a great awakening. I would call this next phase the great awakening for us.
We'll be back with Rick Rubin and Verdeen White after the break. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
We're back with more from Verdine White of Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Tell me about Charles Stepney. What was his involvement as producer? What did he do? Because, you know, producers do different things. Tell me about him and his involvement in the process.
Well, Charles, first of all, was a great friend of Maurice's, and they worked together at Chess Records. And then Charles had done a lot of arrangements for Ramsey Lewis with Maurice. And Charles was the one that brought Minnie Riperton on the scene. You know, wow. The first album was called Come to My Garden, which was a great, 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 great record. And they just stayed in touch. And then Charles had done the Last Days and Times record for us. The first record we did for Clive Davis on Columbia Records, Charles did that. Then Charles came back again and worked with us on Open Our Eyes, That's the Way the World, the breakthrough record for us, and the Spirit record, which he passed away on the Spirit record. And Charles was our father figure, big brother. He was the one that Maurice would listen to the most. Charles would say, we're going to do it like this, and Reese would do it. And Charles was great for myself and Philip and all of us together. And he was actually to our George Martin.
Even though you guys are from Chicago, do you consider yourself a Chicago band or do you consider yourself a California band?
I say California now, you know, because I became an adult here. You know, we came from Chicago, which brought a certain sensibility, you know, to it, you know.
Yeah.
And a good foundation, you know, because I came from a good family background. My mom and dad, my dad was a doctor. My mom was a school teacher. And we had a lot of music around the house. So that was good. That's what I brought to California. And then when I got with Maurice, you know what I mean? You know, working with him closely and living with him, I had a chance to figure out where he was coming from. And he would talk to me about music a lot, you know? And then we became Californians. He did too. You know what I mean? Because we got into yoga, we got into meditation, we got into eating good, we got into, you know, going to seminars at the Bodhi Tree, you know, things like that. You know what I mean? So we became actually California, you know, California. Started eating yogurt. So yeah, you know.
How important was the spiritual aspect in addition to the music? Like,
well, Reese was sort of always open, you know what I mean? You know, he was always open, you know, and it was always loose. It was never like heavy. It was not like a dogma, you know what I'm talking about. It was loose. We didn't get in each other's way spiritually, things like that. It was just a progression, you know what I mean? And then, you know, we adopted, you know, a lot of the California stuff, which was actually kind of natural. Of course, we didn't do that. You couldn't do that in Chicago. That would be too weird, lighting incense, you know what I mean? And but it was, we got into the California thing, you know, which was wide open. I don't think we ever would have made it as big had we not come to California.
It opened your mind to new things being in California, you think?
Right, and new creativity. Because don't forget now, this is where everybody came, you know, this is where everybody is coming back to now, you know what I mean? because of the just the openness of thought, of possibilities, you know.
There was, you came from a musical household. Tell me about the actual music that would be playing in the house. What do you remember? First memories as a kid, what might be playing in the house?
Anything. It was nine of us, so it was noisy. So you get it, you get in where you fit in. And so in one room, my sister would be listening to the radio station WVON of Chicago. She used to listen to Purvis Spann, the blues man. My dad would be listening to Mahalia Jackson because he loved Mahalia Jackson, you know, things like that. My mom loved Lou Rawls, Live at the Copa, you know. And then me and my brother Monty and my brother Freddie, you know, we thought we were cool. So we would be listening to, like, you know, Miles Davis, Four and More, and Miles in the Sky. We love that record. You know, we were teenagers. So if you told people you listened to Miles Davis, you were cool, even if you didn't listen to it. The fact that you knew him. so we were the hip guys. We wanted to be, we were cool, lighting incense in our bedroom. So that's kind of like what was going on. And my baby sisters were just babies at the time, but it was a lot of how, very free form household, very free form. Was never, it was not that strict. It was actually, for that era, it was quite loose. You know what I mean? You know, it wasn't like spankings. I'm going to get you when I'm in spankings, you know, things like that, you know.
Also interesting for the, how eclectic the band was to grow up in an eclectic household. Makes sense. It's like, it makes sense because it was never, Earth, Wind & Fire was never one thing. You know, it always right. felt bigger than one thing. We may talk about funk being a backbone, but it was not just that right. at all. Where so many funk bands were just that.
I would have to say a lot of those funk bands, a lot of those guys grew up together, you know, probably buddies in school and things like that. But in our world, you know, Maurice was the leader, so he had traveled around the whole, we hadn't been anywhere. So a lot of the things that he knew, he turned us on to him. You know what I mean? So he turned us on to a lot of different philosophies that he was into and things like that. We went to Egypt, you know what I mean? And Maurice and I went to Egypt and Israel and things like that. So, you know, he was a world guy, you know, he was a very different type of person, you know. And then don't forget now, you know, Earth and Fire was formulated, he formulated it in the 60s, which was at the first wave of cosmic consciousness, obviously, you know, things like that. It was like the yes. precursor to what everybody now has a yoga mat. Now everybody has a yoga mat.
They didn't used to.
They didn't. You know, they didn't even know what it was. Now everybody has one, you know.
I was going to ask about, you talking about Miles Davis, and I was going to ask you about the influence of jazz in the band.
Right.
How did jazz work itself into, or the fact that you guys listened to jazz growing up, did that influence Earth, Wind & Fire?
Well, you know, Maurice was the ultimate jazzer of the band, you know, and Charles Stepney played jazz too, great jazz. So it was really good for us to kind of turn us on, and Philip and myself and Ralph and Ralph's a really big jazzer, really excellent, you know about the history of jazz. Really, he's really the expert in the band of jazz, and Philip is too. And what was great about it for me, being around Maurice, but then I had a chance to hang out with Philip a lot. He would play me music. And us being the same age, you know, he could maybe explain it to me what was going on. Whereas Maurice just threw us in there. You got to jump in and fit in, you know, okay, because the music is taking off. And so I could say, hey, man, so what did he just say? You know, so it was good that I had a chance to, you know, grow in this band listening to jazz, you know, because I sort of kind of caught the tip end of jazz playing upright to bass guitar.
So when you were playing upright, did you learn playing jazz and classical?
Yeah. And it was good for technique, but then right at the doorstep was bass guitar, Fender bass, that guys like myself and then Stanley Clark and Marcus Miller, Nathan East, Michael Henderson, you know, that wave started. So that's when I kind of like started, when it kind of was like jazz funk yeah. and jazz pop influence, you know.
Did you ever have an opportunity to play upright bass on any Earth, Wind & Fire records?
Only one. It was only one. And I did it on one of our shows. I Write a Song when I did it on that section. But it actually sounded better on bass guitar, really, actually.
Cool.
You know what I mean? You know, I'm glad I played it because it was good for technique. It fights back when I practice. The practices on upright are horrible. The ones on bass guitar are fun. I took a lesson from Ron Carter and at his house. And And it was a horrible lesson. He said, man, this was not good. This is not good. I said, Sir Ronnie, I said, I'm practicing. I said, but tonight you'll see what I really do. You know what I'm talking about? So he came to Madison Square Garden, and he thought he was in the wrong. He thought he was at a basketball game. There were so many people. You thought about, you know what I mean? So I said, Ronnie, this is what I really do. You know what I'm talking about? You know? But I said, I love to practice anyway. And I wanted to have the opportunity of hanging out with Ron Carter and taking a lesson, even if it was horrible.
So cool. So you've gotten to make albums consistently since, I guess, first album in 1970, 71. Is that about right?
Yeah, 70, right. Those 70, 71, right.
It's like 50 years, unbelievable. Yeah. And the technology keeps changing.
Right.
Popular music keeps changing. Tell me about your experience in watching the changes and reacting to the changes, either by swinging with what's going on or by not, you know, like just choosing, well, we're not, this is what they're doing now, we're just going to do this instead. Talk to me about just what you saw, the changes in the way music has been recorded, let's say.
Well, we've watched the changes, you know, from we're at 4-track to 8-track, right? 24-track, right? We went through that phase, right? Yep. Which we watched, and we were part of that. Then we watched, of course, you know, CDs, right? DVDs, all of those things, Pro Tools, you know what I mean? So it's just part of just the evolution. And I think that if you have a pretty much of a foundation, you can swing with it. You know, I think if you don't have a foundation, you'll run to the technology without and forget the music.
Yeah.
You know, we had a strong musical background. So we could say, well, how did this fit into our music?
Beautiful. Let's talk about James Brown for a minute. Was James Brown an important figure musically for Earth, Wind & Fire, would you say?
Sort of like. He wasn't like first. As funky as he was, and I know I'm going to get some pushback.
No, it's fine. It's interesting. I really want to understand the inspiration is a big part of how we get where we're going. We still bring ourselves to it, but it's interesting, like, what's coming through that gets us where we're going.
What I loved about him was his live performances. That's what I loved. That's the one. You know, the one, if you want to see some James Brown stuff, watch the Tammy Show.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And somebody told me it took 90 minutes for those girls to stop screaming after he got, after he did what he did, you know, you know what I mean? And he was just one of them. You know, it was James Brown, it was Miles Davis, it was John Coltrane for us, you know what I mean? And things like that, you know?
But also the Beatles and all.
Oh, the Beatles. Those guys, I think what they did, they were sort of like, I think they were the ones that busted the door wide open. If you go back and listen to, like, when they would Mop Tops and I Want to Hold Your Hand and all the way down to Abbey Road, the work they did was really incredible. And what they did was really good. What the record that showed how hip they was Rubber Soul. That was the one. Rubber Soul was the record. And it was almost like the joke was on us because they knew so much about what they were doing and it just kept... I mean, different. And you could really think that Sgt. Pepper really actually was a record of samples, really, when you really look back at it with the machine going backwards and things like that. And then they had somebody like George Martin to make musical sense of what was in their ears, what they were listening to. They did something in one group that everybody has bitten off of. You know, they, first of all, a group that got massively big, which everybody dreams about, right? Hit records, right? Important records, right? Cultural icons forever, right? Spirituality with Transcendental Meditation and Maharishi Yad Yogi, right? So they're like sort of like more of a than a group. They're sort of like an entity. That's how I look at their work.
I think of the Beatles as proof of God. It's like that. It's, do you know? It's like it's too much. It's too much. It's too. Right. This is not the work of four boys from a little country town, you know, in the north of England.
That's right.
It's much bigger than that.
Absolutely. It's much bigger. It really changed the world that everybody has bitten off of in one way or another. You know, when I talk about Miles in the Sky, that's when Miles started going towards the rock thing. You know what I mean? That's when Miles got hip, you know, in the 60s, you know, things like that. And that's when a lot of music changed, you know, because of the chord changes and songwriting. You know, that was the first time artists wrote their own songs in a band. So great work by them, really great work. They were the first ones that, you know, did movies, you know.
Yeah. So another piece that makes sense is if I think of if I compare Earth, Wind & Fire to other funk bands, Earth, Wind & Fire always had songs where funk bands often had great grooves that weren't necessarily songs.
Right.
So, and same holds true if we look at James Brown versus the Beatles. James Brown always had the groove, but it wasn't always about the song. It might just be about the pocket. Right. But the Beatles had the songs.
And don't forget, now, Maurice was a song person. Before he got with Ramsey, he was a session drummer. So he did commercials. So he understands probably the intro, the chorus, the verse, the hook. What is it saying, you know? Actually, we did the cover of the Beatles, Got to Get You My Life, in the Sgt. Pepper movie. And what happened was that George Martin had lunch with Maurice and myself about the movie. But he didn't have time to work with us because he was working with Aerosmith and the Bee Gees and Billy Preston, you know. And he said, why don't you guys just do your own thing? And that's what we did. And it was the number one, it was the biggest song on that movie.
Beautiful.
Because the movie was a huge flop. I mean, you know, when you go back, people don't know that now, but it was not as big as they thought it was going to be. But we had the record and we still play the song today.
I remember going to see it in the theater as a kid. I may have been one of a few people in that theater, but I was in the theater watching that.
Yeah, we shot in Culver City, and we were in the middle of, we had just got back, had a day off from one of our tours, and we had to shoot everything, like, you know, in one day. You know, that's how fast it was going. You know, Robert Stigwood, back then, you know, more, let's go, you know.
Yeah. Did you meet Stigwood?
Yeah.
Interesting character. I've only heard about him. I've never met him.
Yeah, he was very nice to us. You know, we were kids at the time, so everybody was nice, you know. But what one of the significant things is it was Michael Schultz, the African-American director. He was one of the first to do a big budget movie. That was a big budget movie, you know, Rick. But it was a great time to be part of a movie and things like that, you know.
We'll be back with Rick Rubin and Verdine White after the break. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards, a hotel upgrade, lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer.
starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss-Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast. Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest. We're back with more from Verdine White of Earth, Wind, and Fire.
I'm just picturing the world that you were in then, you know?
Right.
Did it feel different than the other things that were going on? Could you tell that your band was different?
Well, we definitely were in the Earth, Wind, and Fire bubble. You know what I mean? Because don't forget now, we were doing something that had never, ever been done before, you know? You know, no group had ever tried the things, you know, that we tried, you know? And at that time, you know, we were getting ready to go to Columbia Records when Clive was president of Columbia Records. And Clive gave us everything we needed to do it. You know what I mean? So we felt really secure, you know? And we knew we could do it. We knew we were gonna do really good if we just keep at it. We didn't really know what was going on with everybody else, actually. We knew, but we didn't, you know, we weren't part of it, you know?
And in today's world, if an artist doesn't break really on their first project, they tend to go away. And you guys got to really build over a period of time. It was really, was it like the fourth or fifth album that really broke through?
It was the That's the Way the World record with Shining Star on it.
And is that about fifth, would you say?
That about fifth. We had Last Season Times, right? Heads of the Sky, Open Our Eyes, right? Then That's the Way the World. That was, what, four, right? Four.
So for those first three albums, you guys already had been touring, playing like clubs?
We were playing, not clubs a lot, but student unions, you know? Gymnasiums and
wow.
On with, like I said, groups like Ohio Players and Mandrill, you know, those kind of things. And then the show that broke us big was a show called Soul in 1971, 72, out of New York City. And they played the show about 19 times.
It was a TV show?
A television show called Soul.
Wow, I'd never heard of it.
Yeah, right. It's an obscure show now, but back it was a very important show. It was before, wow, Soul Train. Not a lot of dancing, but it was a show that had a lot of artists on it. And it was a show that had politicians on it, like Jesse Jackson and The Last Poets, right, at that time. You know, so we were kind of in that thing at that time.
That sounds great. I'm going to try to find old episodes. I've never even heard of it before. That sounds great.
Yeah, man. And the show opens up with Maurice playing Kalimba.
Wow.
Yeah.
So cool.
You know, it was like, you know, an intro was like, brothers and sisters, you know, we hear Earth, Wind, and Fire tonight, do the blah, 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 right, you know? And it was an eclectic show, but it was a very powerful show, and we fit right in at that particular time.
Understood. And that's really what broke things open, you think?
Yeah, you know, and then we were playing a lot of colleges. We were on the road a lot, so those records were selling like, you know, 200,000, 300,000, half a million. So we were on our way to That's the Way the World. It just wasn't a unicorn that came out of nowhere. It was a build-up to that.
Did it feel like it was a constant build, or was it kind of a plateau at a good level until it exploded?
No, it was a constant build. It just kept going, and we kept hearing it out and feeling it, and it kept getting better. But it wasn't like a thing like, you know, oh man, we got a big hit record. We just kept going. You know, it was like, we just kept growing, kept going, you know?
So then when things did explode, it seems like you'd be able to handle it better based on doing all the work leading up to it. You know, some artists, when good things happen really fast, they kind of flame out.
Right. It was a little overwhelming, you know, because it was big. You know, when it gets big, it kind of bounces back off of you, you know. But I think the fact that we had done records before, you know, we had enough with ourselves not to, like, go crazy.
Cool. Do you remember the first experience of thinking, wow, this is really getting big?
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was like when I heard That's the Way the World, you know, we recorded at Caribou Ranch back in the day. Remember Caribou? You know, Jim Curcio's place, right? And after Maurice mixed the record and edited it and everything, he let me hear the record. I said, man, goose pimples. It was like, I mean, is that us?
Wow.
Right? You know, is that us? Is it that good? And actually, it was great for Maurice because after Step had passed, Maurice had to take over, you know, as a producer. So, you know, so he had to wear like three or four hats, you know what I'm talking about. And one of the things that I'd have to say, nobody who ever played drums came off the drums and ever did what Maurice ended up doing. And became an icon and became a, you know, musical leader and things like that. And helped the industry, too. If it hadn't been for Maurice, there would never have been African-Americans doing concerts. And we actually had to keep up with him. You know, he was just one of those rare people that really kind of knew exactly what he wanted. Even in the beginning of those records that we did that were not hits, the genesis of the sound was there. You know, you can still hear it. You know, it was there, you know, the foundation of the sound, you know.
The transition from playing in gymnasiums to what was the next step after gymnasiums as things got bigger?
Theaters, then arenas, then stadiums. And so when we play theaters and arenas and stadiums, now they're for different reasons. Like we did the classics with the Eagles and everybody a couple of years ago. So that was great, a lot of fun. A lot of that audience probably had never seen us before, you know, on the stage with the Eagles. The arenas are good because they put our big production in there, you know. So a lot of the people can see us on the big screens. Theaters are great because we get a chance to play longer and we can play songs from some of the jazzier things in a theater because it fits the environment. You know, it's like if you're going to watch, you know, a great movie, it's better in a theater.
Absolutely.
I call it like in a theater, it's great. A lot of ghosts in those theaters, you know.
Yeah. I think you can hear the music better in a theater than in an arena as well. It's just like it's a more musical experience.
Yeah, well, that arena stuff is all show business.
Yeah.
You know, it's all show business. You know, it's big. That means you're big. And that means the box office is great.
You know?
And that means you're successful. And it means you're hot. You know, that's what, that means you're happening.
Yeah. As much fun playing big show, small show, just playing. And do you know it when you're in it or... does the music kind of take over in a way where once the show starts, you could be anywhere?
Yeah, well, I think for us now, we all know each other so well, we kind of know what that thing is. You know, we know, okay, it's an arena, so we got to strap in and find out where the space is so it'll feel good.
It's like greatest hits. It's greatest hits.
Yeah, and it's star time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And when you do a stadium, it's like you're on the moon. They can't catch you. You know how people say, so what are you guys playing at tonight? Dodger Stadium. And people don't say anything to you because it's bigger than them, you know?
Yeah. And in a place like Dodger Stadium, it's more like it's the event. You get to say you were there. But it's rarely about like the intricacies of the performance because you're too far away and the sound just dissipates.
But if you find a space, you can really nail them. Like, you know, we found that arena space. And then when Philip at the end told the audience, wave your hands in the air, we had 60,000 people waving their hands in the air. And because what's great about social media and things like that, they get a chance to tell their friend what they just saw. Whereas before, in the 70s, if you did it, nobody knew except the people that came.
Yeah, so now word spreads. And when you talk about playing, like doing shows with bands like the Eagles, In this recent round, that probably was more like in the very early days, you probably got to play with bands, a much more eclectic group of bands. Like, I think, didn't you guys play with like Love and Spoonful? And
right, we opened up for John Sebastian. Remember, John was in the Love and Spoonful.
Yes.
And John let us do a tour with him.
Incredible.
And we played Lincoln Center with him. And Clive Davis came to see John.
Yeah.
But he came to see, then he saw us and said, listen, I like those guys. I want to get together with those guys. That's how that happened. And to this day, John and I are great friends. Just wonderful person. Just really great. Just really great. Always sweetheart, you know.
Beautiful. Tell me about signing with Clive. And you said that he gave you what you needed to do.
Right.
It just sounds like it really worked out. Your experience with Warner Brothers before that didn't work as well. But how was the relationship with the people?
Well, with Warner's, at the time, Joe Smith was running the label. Joe was, you know. Mo was there, but Mo was actually doing Reprise, you know. You know, Frank Sinatra's label. And that's when Mo came later, you know. But we only did two records for Joe. Mm-hmm. And then Clive had heard about us. But Warner's, they weren't really ready. They weren't really ready for a group of color, you know what I mean? And Joe was cool. We got out of there, you know what I mean? And then Clive saw us, you know. Clive bought the contract from Warner's. But Clive, you know, he was, you know, running CBS Records, and CBS Records was on fire, you know what I mean? You know, you had Sly and the Family Stone. You had all those great groups, you know what I mean, that Clive had, you know what I mean? And he was the one that opened up that door for us, brought us to the Grosvenor House, you know, in London, so everybody could take a look at us and it was expensive. So really, Earth, Wind & Fire was like the great American experiment that worked.
Yeah.
Because it hadn't happened. Don't forget now, the only game in town was Motown. Right? When you look at it, you know, for where the African Americans could go to be successful.
Absolutely.
Of that nature, to be that big.
Hadn't happened yet.
It hadn't happened yet. What we did hadn't happened, you know. So after we happened, then that's when you saw Funkadelics. That's when you saw Bootsy Collins. That's when you saw, probably James Brown was the only one in the 60s that got big. But he was by himself, though. He was the only game in town.
And as we said, it wasn't based on, in my opinion, it wasn't based on the songs. It was just based on he had the sound that nobody had at that time.
That's right. And then he was so great live that when they put him on a Tammy show and Ed Sullivan, lights out. So after, you know, that, when we came along, it was a whole different generation of artists. And then don't forget now, African-American radio had gotten big. You know what I mean? Yeah. Went from AM to FM stereo. So you had great disc jockeys playing records, like, you know, the late Frankie Crocker that was breaking all those great records, but in different genres, though.
Absolutely. But you guys played on all radio. It wasn't just urban radio. You guys played on everything. I mean, right. I heard you on every station.
But Clive was always great. And even to this day, we always get a big hug from Clive. We've done his the Clive Party a lot, and we've done his documentaries and things like that. But always will be forever indebted, because he gave us the big break that opened the door for us.
Yeah.
That stayed open.
He's historically known for having a lot to say about songs. Would he get involved in that way, or would he just be supportive?
At that time, I think when he went to Arista, that's when he got into it. You know, because Columbia was so big, you know, it was so monolithic, you know, big corporation. But he was there for us anyway, you know what I mean? Whatever we want to do, we could do it. And Clive loved Maurice, so, you know, he always trusted Reese.
Beautiful. Tell me a little bit about your music listening habits now.
I listen to everything. Sometimes I'll go back to the past to see if I still liked it when I liked it before, to see if my ears are on point. I'm having a chance to, like, really do some nice work, you know. Of course, we will do an Earth, Wind & Fire album at some point. But recently, I've had a chance to work with my drummer, John Parris, from the band, and Neil Pohl, great engineer, great producer, great writer. He just got nominated for 2 Grammys. So we get a chance to talk about music, chop it up, work on tracks, you know, it keeps me active, things like that. And I still practice. I still, you know, what I like about the quarantine, actually, it's really, you know, it's been kind of cool, because I've had a chance to really be creative, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, with no judgment on it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you ever played on anyone else's records?
Oh, yeah, I did. Oh, Flo Rida, DJ Cassidy, a lot of stuff. And then what happens is, when I work with other people, the session is like 3 hours. But they ask me questions and it turns into 11 hours. And when I saw Pharrell about a year ago, he was humming to me. When people meet me, they hum the songs. He was humming Running, you know? They hum the songs. So it might start out as a 2-hour session, but they want to know everything, what was going on. They want to know what the world was like.
Yeah.
You know, they want to know what it smelled like, you know?
Yes.
What it sounded like. So when I do sessions, they're like 11 hours, not because we're playing. They just want to, you know, you know what I'm saying?
It's so funny.
And then now I'm getting adopted now. So if I work with an artist, you know, they said, you know what? I'm going to make you my uncle. You know what I mean? You know? And they said, anything I can bring you? You know what I mean? Could you want some coffee? You know? But they want to know, which I think is really great. You know what I mean? That obviously they respect you enough to want to know what happened. I work with LL Cool J, and you know, he's great, you know, big muscles and everything. He did the introduction for us at the Kennedy Center Honors. And he said, you know, man, I had a poster of all y'all stuff, man, in my bedroom. And I'm saying, wow, you know what I'm talking about? And then I said, listen, I got to take a picture because I need some street cred.
Amazing. Thank you for talking to me about music and about your life. And thank you for making the world a better place.
Thank you, man. And thank you for letting me on your show. All righty.
A pleasure, sir.
Love you.
Thanks to Verdeen White for bringing us into his inner Earth, Wind & Fire circle. You can hear all of our favorite Earth, Wind & Fire songs on our playlist at brokenrecordpodcast.com. And be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/brokenrecordpodcast, where you can find extended cuts of new and old episodes. Also, follow us on Twitter @brokenrecord. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Martin Gonzalez, Eric Sandler, Jennifer Sanchez, with engineering help from Nick Chafee, and is executive produced by Mia LaBelle. We're a production of Pushkin Industries. And if you like Broken Record, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Peace.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
It all started with two federal agents who heard a rumor.
She mentions, well, there is this alleged murder to have taken place.
There was just one problem. They had no clue who the victim was.
We have to do our job, and we have to find out, who did they kill?
It had been 15 years since this alleged murder. Was it still possible to unearth the truth?
I used to watch the Unsolved Mystery shows, and I often thought about calling, because I was like, this is not right. How can a person get killed and no one knows anything?
I'm Jake Halpern, and this is Deep Cover, The Nameless Man. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to hear the entire season right now, ad-free, subscribe to Pushkin Plus on our Apple Podcast show page or on pushkin.fm/plus.